At the moment, we are going through a series as a church called Grow, and this is part three of that series. You can grow as a Christian. It's the way you and I have been made. Christ has gifted Christians with a new life, and all authentic, real life grows. So you and I can grow. But how do we grow? That's one of the things we're going to look at this morning. But first, who grew? Which partner of the church family is this? Anybody got any ideas? Look carefully at the expression. No, the young girl in a dress with a ribbon in her hair is not Andy Malcolm. Good try. Others? Pardon? Crystal. Is it Crystal? No. No. No, it's not Pam Morley. Would the person here depicted please stand up? Janet Sharp, who had no idea that photo was going to appear. Pete might need lunch today. Who's this cheeky chappy showing a bit of thigh? Bruce? No, Bruce, you get picked on a lot in this competition, don't you? No, it's not Bruce. Who else is that? It's too new a photo for Bruce, someone said. Yeah, no, it's in colour. That gives it away. Anybody got any ideas? Pardon? John Last. Is it John Last? No, says John. It's Tim Clark. No, it's not Tim Clark. Okay. Who is it? It is Pete Goddard. Yeah. Yeah. The missing link in the evolutionary chain. Anyway. So, let's move on. So we can grow, and this morning is about how we do that as Christians. Colossians chapter 2, verses 6 to 8. We're just going to look at a couple of verses this morning. So then, just as you received Christ Jesus as Lord, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him, strengthened in the faith as you were taught, and overflowing with thankfulness. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the elemental spiritual forces of this world rather than on Christ. So what's that got to teach us about growing? First of all, it's important to understand that when Paul was writing Colossians, he was a very worried man. His writing was birthed in a kind of anxiety for the church in Colossae. He'd been so encouraged when people had become Christians there and he'd heard about their journey of faith. It was fantastic. The gospel was growing and he'd heard great reports of how their faith was doing in those early days. But now he's worried because he's heard some very concerning things about the church in Colossae, about how false teachers had come in and were deceiving them. And as he says here in verse 8, taking them captive. He's one captive writing to another. Remember, he's in prison in Rome at the time of writing this letter. And so any news that he gets from Colossae, which was in Turkey, has either got to come by sea or across the land between Turkey and Rome. And so that whole distance without any email or Skype, kind of just that time just makes him more and more anxious. These guys have been doing so well in their young faith, and now it's being threatened. The church is in danger of being completely knocked off course because of these false teachers. No one knows exactly what they were teaching, but people do their kind of homework based on the kind of things that Paul talks about in the letter to the Colossians. And it seems that these people had come into the church and at first seemed to be very Christian, but then started getting them into all sorts of religious ceremonies, taking them back to kind of mystical experiences of the law, telling them to treat their bodies very harshly, all sorts of things like that. The detail of what these false teachers were teaching doesn't actually matter that much. The point is, Paul was worried, and he writes the letter of Colossians to try and solve the problem, to try and encourage Christians to stay faithful and rooted to the real Jesus. When damaging ideas and teachings invade the church that threaten its growth, it's the church's responsibility to take a stand against false teachers and to make it clear that such teaching imprisons the church. It captivates them. False teaching isn't just a problem in the book of Colossians. It's actually a problem all the way through the history of the Christian church, and it's a problem today, even more so with our media-saturated world where we can get all sorts of books, teaching videos, CDs, websites. There's a lot of naff ideas out there which pretend to be Christian but actually kind of deceive people. I don't want to get into the details of this morning because I fear distracting the congregation from the main point. But in any generation, the false teaching that gets in the church is just like that story in Greek mythology of the Trojan horse. The story goes that for 10 years, the Greeks had besieged the city of Troy, trying to knock down its walls, and they could never get in. And so the whole army of the Greeks made this big show of sailing away and left just this massive horse. What the occupants of Troy didn't realize was that they'd left their most elite fighters in the middle of this horse. And so the inhabitants of the city of Troy, impenetrable for 10 years, opened the gates and brought in the horse to celebrate. They shut the gates, they all go to bed, and in the middle of the night, so the mythology goes, the guys jump out the horse, open the gates, the Greek army has sailed back in, and what the army couldn't do in 10 years, the Trojan horse did in one night, because people opened the doors to something they thought was great, and it ended up destroying them. That's what happens in the church generation after generation, and that's why most of the New Testament letters written by Paul were actually written, because he was so worried about this Trojan horse effect. And so that was Paul's motivation. And so he's got to try and talk to them about, so how do you stay faithful? You started growing as a Christian. How do you stay growing as a Christian? And Paul addresses that in chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. The rest of the chapter, he goes on to address a whole number of the false things that these teachers were teaching. And this is foundational for the rest of what he's going to say. In chapter 2, Paul starts to address the false teaching of this Trojan horse at Colossae head on. And it summarizes much of what he's written so far and goes on to look at what he's about to say. And it's this verse I want us to look at this morning. Colossians chapter 2, verse 6, Paul says, "So then." And I imagine him doing a really big sigh as he's chained up in prison in Rome or in house arrest, we're not quite sure, but he'd probably be dictating this letter. I imagine him just going, "So then." Because "so then" links what he's about to say with everything that he's said so far. All these great truths that he's just been talking about, he now says, "So then." Those great truths that we've looked over the last few weeks. Things like, "For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins." So then, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for everything was made by him and for him." So then, "Once you were alienated from God, enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation." So then, do you see what Paul's doing? He's taking all of these great truths so far and he says, "Do you really believe it? Is it really true? Because if it is, it has massive implications. Two little words which mean a great deal. Is everything I've written so far reality? If it is, it makes the world of difference. So then, when we come to church like this, it's a so then moment. So then, are we actually going to dare to believe and live out what our faith tells us? In communion, later this morning, it's a so then moment. Bread and wine. So, did Jesus die for you? So then, what difference is that going to make? Every generation of Christians has so then moments where we decide if what we believe is going to change the way we live. It's been described as the longest journey in the world, the 18 inches from our head to our heart, from where what we believe determines how we live. So then, we were talking about last week how Christians have lost their nerve today, and we're under huge pressure to kind of water down what we believe and not suggest for a moment that our proclamation that Jesus Christ is Lord has any implications whatsoever on people that are in our society today. That they're tolerant of our faith as soon as we begin to suggest that there might actually be implications for them. That judgment is real, that sin is a problem that causes death, and hell is a reality to be avoided. As soon as we start talking in those terms, that society kind of puts this huge pressure on us to simply shut up because it doesn't fit with the tolerance of our culture. And in your places of work, I was going to say and mine, but that would be misleading. in your places of work, there will be that subtle pressure. People may even be respectful of your faith until it begins to impinge on others that it might have implications. And in our culture, the same challenge is true. So then, what difference to what we believe to the way we live? I speak to a mixed congregation, and some of us are here this morning holding on to faith by our fingertips because this world is taking us captive, just like false teaching was taking the Colossians captive. We kind of believe in this Jesus, but we have become paralyzed about living radically and talking dramatically about him because the pressures of our world have captivated us. And Jesus and Paul and the scriptures and church is here to say to people simply, the world has changed, but the gospel has not. The gospel is there to change the world. Jesus died to rescue us. It was true then, and it is true now. The longest 18 inches in the world. So then, how does this stuff change the way we live? And then Paul goes on in that next sentence. How does the church connect head and heart? How does the church keep growing? The answer is actually incredibly simple. It might be a complicated problem, but the way to keep growing is actually very simple. And Paul just says, just in the same way as you started out in faith, carry on. Just in the same way as you received Christ Jesus as Lord, continue to live in him. Christ Jesus as Lord is a great summary of all that Paul has written so far. Everything was made by him and for him. Jesus Christ is Lord. Lord absolutely, Lord universally, Lord eternally, without equal, not one among a list of alternatives. He is Lord. Christians receive him as their master, as the king of the universe, as the ultimate truth, as the king of kings and the Lord of lords. There is no other, and his name is Jesus. It is a summary of everything Paul has written so far. And the challenge to the church at Colossae is to keep on taking Jesus at his word, to not lose their nerve, to trust him still, to trust him just as they started with him, just as you received Christ. Paul could say, just as he received Christ, because he knew that they'd been birthed well. He knew that they'd become Christians with some really good teaching. He talks twice about the bloke who took the gospel to Colossae, a guy called Epaphras, and both times he calls him a faithful minister. And in Colossians chapter 1, he talks about how from the day they heard about this faith, they were growing in their love for Jesus and they're growing in their love for others. They were well birthed and they had the real gospel. He talks in chapter 1, verse 6 about, and since you understood God's grace in all its truth. In other words, Paul could say, carry on now as you started because I know that you had the real gospel. You really were committed. You were loving God. You were loving people. And it was entrusted to you by this guy, Epaphras. To be honest, I'm not so sure that Paul would say the same to the Western church today. I'm not sure he would say to us this morning, just in the same way as you received Christ Jesus as Lord, continue in him. Because Paul couldn't be so certain that we'd all become Christians on the same solid foundation that they had done at Colossae. I'm not sure that that can be said of the way we do conversion to Christianity in the West today, where Jesus as Lord is just one of a number of options in a whatever kind of culture, which waters it down into some kind of, well, yeah, no, this could look quite good for me, rather than that sacrificial commitment to Jesus, giving him our everything. Have a think about it. Does this apply to you? Why did you become a Christian? You know, why did you become a Christian? When I think about that question, I remember going to a youth club every Saturday night. I went there because I was very attracted to one of the girls in the youth group. The leaders of this group thought that I went there because they put on this exciting program. I went there because Libby went there. It was as simple as that. And then when we got there, we'd do all these different games, and then at the end of the meeting, there would be this, what they called an epilogue, where we'd go upstairs into this room, and it was clear that all the people who took this epilogue had all been trained in the same place, because they could be talking about all sorts of subjects, and it would get to near the end of the evening, and then they'd get very serious, they'd lean forward, and they'd say, what happens if you leave here tonight and get run over by a bus? Now, that was fascinating. Number one, the church wasn't on a bus route. So what was a bus doing there anyway? And number two, how did the bus driver know the difference between Christians and non-Christians anyway? And why were these maniac bus drivers trying to mow down people on a Saturday night besides? But eventually, I understood what they were talking about. They were talking about hell. And I knew I didn't want to go there. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I became a Christian. Just in case you weren't sure. I became a Christian because of what was in it for me. I became a Christian because it was fantastic health insurance just with longer terms. I'm not sure Paul would say to me, just in the same way as you received Christ Jesus as Lord, continue to live in him. Continue to be greedy and selfish and go about your faith as what's in it for you. Do you get my point? When we distort following the lordship of Jesus Christ to a consumer choice where we say, oh yeah, look, that's good, it distorts our faith. The way some of the parts of the church go about evangelism is distorting Christianity. Jesus Christ is Lord. Our evangelism should look more like, hey, listen up people, you've got a choice. Bow the knee now or later. The choice is yours. He is Lord. Now, of course, I'd never say it like that. But I'm saying it that to a group of Christians this morning to get our thinking straight. We're not offering Jesus as an additional lifestyle choice in a consumer society. We are saying he is the way. He is the truth. He is the life. And that's got implications for everybody, like it or not. There is a robustness to this. Imagine if we had come to faith as Christians and it started like this. Okay, so you want to become a Christian. Well, you can forget doing the job you do because you're spending 80 hours of your week just chasing the Western dream. So if you want to become a Christian, chuck that job in and get a job which frees up your time to be the husband or the wife God called you to be valuable and in the advancement of God's kingdom other than just earning the money there. Now, hear me. I'm not suggesting that's what I think everybody should do. I'm just asking you to imagine how that would change our expression of church. Oh, great. So you want to become a Christian. Good. So like the rich young ruler, go and sell your house, give it to the poor, and then come back, and I'll pray the prayer of faith with you. Wow. Could Paul say to us, just in the same way as you receive Christ Jesus as Lord, continue in him? I'm exaggerating here to make a point, but do you hear the point I'm making? That wasn't very assuring. Do you get the point I'm making? Is it little wonder that aspects of Christianity today, like the big worship scene or the contemplative prayer industry, are thriving? Because you have all these people chasing the Western dream who are absolutely knackered and so come to Jesus for a therapeutic fix that happens in certain ways. Now, that will have probably made a third of the congregation really annoyed this morning because you either love Soul Survivor and worship and you love contemplative prayer, and I'm not knocking it. I'm just asking us to take a step back and say, I wonder how we come to faith affects the expressions of Christianity that follow. That's all I want us to think about. Could Paul say to us today, just in the same way as you receive Christ Jesus as Lord, continue in him? I absolutely died with laughter recently reading this beautiful Methodist covenant prayer. As many of you have heard of it, you know, it's the one where it says, let me be employed by thee, or laid aside for thee, exalted for thee, or brought low for thee. Let me be full, let me be empty. You know, it's a marvelous prayer of declaration. On this blog that I was reading this on, the lady said, oh, it's a beautiful prayer, but unnecessarily extreme for today's world. Stupid woman. What a plonker. Presumably the cross of Jesus was unnecessarily extreme as well. How does our culture affect the expressions of our faith? So then, just as you receive Christ Jesus as Lord, continue to live your lives in him, said Paul to the Colossians. That's how you keep growing, with that radical submission to Jesus. My whole life is yours, and I will spend the rest of my life loving you and loving people. If you want to keep growing, just keep saying and doing that. Go back to where you began. And how do you know that that's happening? Well, in verse 7, Paul says, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him, strengthened in the faith as you were taught, and overflowing with thankfulness. It's really a lovely, simple picture that actually, as we continue a life of surrender to Jesus, our roots go deeper and deeper in him, we are built up in him, and we produce fruit. I took this photo, for those listening online, this part of the service will really bless you. I took this photo in North Wales, and North Wales is rock everywhere, and so tree roots can't go very far down. You notice how this tree had to spread its roots very, very wide because it couldn't get the penetration through the rock. And so when the storm came, this tree blew over. We don't often get to see roots, but you can see precisely why that tree blew down. Contrast that with this at Coldwatham. And in Coldwatham, there is an old sand pit that is about 30 feet deep, a gravel pit. And from the erosion of the sides of that gravel pit, it's exposed the roots. Now, that tree up there, that pine tree, isn't particularly big. But these roots are going 30 feet down, and this part is twice the size of my arm, and there's a whole network of those roots, and they're at least 30 foot down and still keeping going. That's the image I want you to have in mind when we think about Paul saying being rooted and built up in him. That actually as we keep on surrendering our lives to Jesus, as we have a chance to around the communion table this morning, we can be rooted in him, deeply, deeply rooted. And how do we know we're rooted? Again, it's very simple. Because we'll be overflowing with thankfulness. Thankfulness was a big deal for Paul in Colossians. He spoke about it 6 times in the book. If we are continuing to surrender our lives, we will be rooted in God. Those things help us grow. Do you know how we know if we're growing? Because it's measured by this overflow of thankfulness. That God has already done something in our lives, which means that we just express gratitude. And one of the, you know, I don't often quote Greek here, but one of the commentaries on this passage talk very much about how Paul's idea here is that this happens when we meet together. That just in the same way as the Greeks worship their idols individually, the church worships their God collectively, and there is an overflow of thankfulness when we meet together. It's probably one of the saddest things about my time here at Maybridge that I can think of the times when our joy has overflowed in our times together and put them on probably one hand. What does that say about our Western faith? That actually when we get together, I'm not talking about a style of music here, I'm just talking about a heart attitude which says, if I don't shout, the rocks will cry out because this God is marvelous. An overflowing of thankfulness. So, photo for the squeamish. We come to an end. How do we keep growing as Christians? We keep going back to that moment of our birth. To keep growing, we have to go back to the start. And we have to ask ourselves, did I start well? Or does God want to develop my understanding of why I came to faith? We need to keep growing. We have to avoid being captured by deceptive ideas. To keep growing, we have to stay rooted in Jesus. To keep growing, we have to hold our nerve that Jesus really is Lord. And to keep growing, you have to keep going back to where you started. And this morning, that's what we get to do in communion. As God by His Spirit would say through the book of Colossians to us this morning, so then, do you believe this stuff? So then, what difference is that going to make to the way we live? I'm going to ask the band to come back now, but I want to ask you to just bow your heads for a moment and think about what we're going to do. Over the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to break bread and drink wine. But it is a so then moment.